This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The birth of televangelism and megachurches turned some of God's servants into wealthy men with household names and a lot of political power. At their side was often a woman, a Tammy Faye Baker or Victoria Osteen, who is equally powerful but required to wield her power in a much different way. Kate Buller is back with a new book exploring the history and role of female church leaders. The Preacher's Wife, The Precarious Power of Evangelical Women Celebrities, talks about the delicate dance of appearing submissive. Kate Buller is a professor of the history of Christianity in North America at Duke University's Divinity School. And Kate Buller is back on our program. Welcome back.
I'm so glad to be here.
What inspired this book?
I was a very stressed out evangelical teenager. I thought, I remember the first time someone told me that there were jobs I couldn't have. As you can imagine, I'm a little bit of a talker. And I thought, wait, there are rules about where I get to talk? I can lead a Bible study. I can lead women and children. But why can't I talk behind the pulpit? What makes something theological speech? And as a 16-year-old, I remember just being very disappointed that there were more boundaries around what I thought my gifts might be able to be.
And this really came home at a camp, right?
It was. I don't know if anyone else had did you have a terrible / wonderful summer camp experience?
No, they were all good, actually, except for the food. But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I had a Mennonite Bible
camp.
Never
went to a Mennonite Bible camp.
They make a lot of their own furniture, as you can imagine.
It's a long week.
It was just very odd to be trying to parse the limits of evangelical female authority in a very bare liturgical world of campfires and sing-alongs. So how do you know what everyone's job is? And I figured it out in a very indirect way. I found out that as a counselor in training, if I was on maintenance duty, I was actually not allowed to drive the truck to the dump with the added bonus of seeing the bare seat garbage, because I would be given cleaning duty instead. And I could also cook, and I could also just prep theological material. I was very disappointed about
that. But
the
you
bears.
Were already evangelical, as you said. You had your anxieties. You go to a Mennonite summer camp. So for goodness sake, there must be something in your family that had prepared you for this.
Well, my parents became Christians pretty late in life. And as a teenager, I realized that there was this larger subculture called evangelicalism. But you have to imagine that in Canada, it was slightly different. Every time they tried to force us to pray around the flagpole, none of us knew what we were supposed to be doing at the time. And so we just had a vague sense that we all loved Jesus, that it had something to do with a personal experience of God in our lives. But we inherited a lot of the, I think, complementarian theology, the idea that men and women have separate spiritual roles from the American magazines and churches that we were hearing about.
So tell us how this plays out and what you discovered. I mean, it's fascinating stuff in terms of this very careful choreography and role playing.
Sure.
Particularly in the age of televangelism.
Yeah. Well, I ruined my 20s traveling around studying megachurches.
When did your life start getting good?
Oh, my gosh. Never?
No.
Never? I loved looking at what congregational forms, especially Americans, had made, where they were quite big, quite splashy. And so I started digging into the history and realized that so many of these attempts at broader evangelism started with a charismatic man and his wife, who very quickly realized that they had all sorts of content to fill. I mean, part of the advent of the idea of a charismatic televangelist was that, frankly, once they went to satellite television, they just had too many hours to fill. So they'd find themselves at 2 a.m. with an accordion being like, is anyone watching? And so women got their own shows. They found themselves to be characters. All of a sudden, their kids were ushered on stage to celebrate Christmas in front of everyone. And soon, an entire franchise around the family was born.
So let's talk about Tammy Faye Baker. You'll probably have to remind us who she is.
Oh, sure.
Amazing.
Oh, Tammy Faye. If you picture a lot of blonde hair and blue eyeshadow and very intense mascara, beside Jim Baker, who you may remember for being successfully indicted for fraud in the late 1980s, Tammy Faye was... her own, she was one of the great Christian celebrities. We might forget that at the time, they started a huge church as well as a television studio in South Carolina. Praise the Lord, Ministries started Heritage Park USA, which after the first two Disneylands, Disneyland, Disney World, was the most visited attraction in the country for some years. So people could come and stop by and go on the roller coaster and go down the giant water slide, watch a live taping of Jim and Tammy Faye, listen to Tammy sing more songs than people signed up for, meet the kids, and stay in a lavish hotel. And it was a whole family experience that was considered sort of jubilant and fun, but sanctified.
Right. So that's part of the show. And Tammy Faye certainly shared the stage with Jim Baker, but really not the spotlight.
Yeah.
And this is what you get into in the book, this way in which you could be a celebrity.
Yeah.
But you couldn't be a pastor.
That's right. And so women develop different titles. So you could be an author and a speaker. If you were a man, you would just be, you know, Pastor yeah. Bob. They called themselves Bible teachers instead of preachers. Later on, when they were the charismatic co-founder of a massive megachurch, they could call themselves co-founders because usually those churches started in the family home. So with eight people, you're really going to give everyone a job. And so very quickly, the wife became one of the first sort of spiritual architects of these really charismatic congregations. And so women got spiritual jobs, whether the men wanted them to or not. And eventually they figured out how to make their own separate female sphere within this very male ecology.
All right, and talk about, and also I mentioned Tammy Faye, so you may be thinking about white televangelists who had arisen in that period, but you also talk about women of color and their role in this and the ways in which this kind of dance plays out a little bit differently, but
yeah.
is still somewhat of a different role.
Yeah, it does. Partly because most of these were Pentecostals, there was a far greater overlap between black and white and then later Latino megachurch pastors. There were famous black televangelists very early on, Carlton Pearson, Reverend Ike, and then later on Bishop T.D. Jakes with his wife Sarita. And Sarita has her own sort of retail arm / debutante program / first lady ministry. But as you can tell in the titles, like first lady, so much of the pageantry around respectability was so important that while later on white women would advertise themselves as being broken and messy and just a girl trying to get by, black women were never afforded the privilege of having sort of so many chips to play. They had to stay on the pedestal that they were given.
And this embodies and kind of enacts for their Christian, this audience, this donating audience, the ideal couple. This
That's
is how
right.
you're supposed to act.
This
right?
is the model family. Everyone wants to know, if marriage works for them, maybe it can work for me. And so maybe you see this entire franchise of marriage advice manuals, parenting advice. I see childbirth advice. It becomes very quickly pragmatic and also therapeutic. So just like you see in politicians' wives where she's supposed to round out the man, she's supposed to offer him a sense like, on the weekend, he wears flannel and he's great with the dog, that there's all kinds of emotional work that person does. And so she takes on a lot of humanizing qualities and therapeutic functions.
And you talked about the various categories, the sort of the performer, the consultant, the therapist.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about these various ways in which women have found a space.
Women carved out a series of very comfortable roles for themselves with only slightly obscuring language. So most common is wife and mom. I'm just a wife and mom. I can read the bio of just a wife and mom who runs a $50 million parachurch organization. And even that word, parachurch, means it's not officially a congregation, but it becomes kind of a specialty ministry. So there's all sorts of ministries that also get that tax-exempt status that can be enormous with huge staffs run by women, but as long as it's for women and kids, it's considered acceptable. So just a wife and mom can run all sorts of things organizationally, as long as it's not the pulpit. There's one of the most common ways women have found their way on stage is by being a performer. So I look at the gospel and contemporary Christian music industries that support women. Because they were so lucrative, there was also even more pressure on them to be perfect. And so you have the Amy Grants of the world who can't possibly get divorced or look even lightly sexual because, God forbid, that is clearly the work of Satan. Mm-hmm. And so you see this massive purity industry around their diaries, the idea that their true love waits, huge pressure on them, even though they're very commercially successful, but also the sense that in every way, their power is borrowed. They come onto a stage they don't own. They have to go through a series of male gatekeepers. And then they can be incredibly charismatic, but then the curtain falls and they have to start all over again next week, earning their place once more.
Any sense that they're, because it does seem like this is a closed ecosystem. Like if you want into this, you get it. Mm-hmm. It can be lucrative. It's a good paying job. Mm-hmm. Just play the role and accept it. Is there much chafing against this, or do you just go somewhere else?
Well, I mean, this is part of the, I'm sure it's kind of funny for people who don't know this world to hear about it, because it is a little bit like NASCAR. If you're into NASCAR, you know where all the tracks are. I am not one of those people. Mm-hmm. But if you are into it, oh my gosh, it's everywhere. It's every Target shelf. It is also in Costco next to the Brussels sprouts. If you look down and you see a woman with beautiful glossy hair, it is likely an evangelical woman who bills herself as just an author, just a wife and mom. And because it's a paraculture, which is to say you kind of have to look carefully to see it, it does tend to have pretty tight rules. Yeah. And it means that when you're out, you're out. So if you're on the inside, you can make a speaking circuit and you can make a life for yourself. But there is woe be unto you who's, for instance, leaves a husband who cheats on her or doesn't want to tolerate saying that she has a spiritual daddy, like Paula White, always had to refer to T.D. Jakes as. They will find themselves on the outs in a culture that will just find somebody else.
Talk about Paula White. This is fascinating. The president has got himself a preacher now. He's got himself his Billy Graham.
It makes me so sad when you say that.
Well, and they're very similar. I mean, both have been married three times, I think. They live in a nice mansion.
Yes. Not Billy Graham, but Donald Trump.
No, Donald Trump and Paula White. Talk about this is a fascinating, in terms of your book and this figure of the female power broker and how they have to wield power. Where does Paula White fit in all this?
Well, it's so weird for me because I wrote the history of the prosperity gospel in which she is a prominent prosperity preacher.
Divine force.
God wants you to prosper. If you have the right kind of faith, God will give you health and wealth and abundant happiness. And then I thought I was going to do something different, and I wrote this book on preachers' wives, and then Paula White becomes the spiritual advisor, the culmination of like 15 years of me being a nerd in one single human being. She's incredible. The fact that she has made a place for an unbelievably unpopular theology beside an unpopular president.
Wait, when you say unpopular, now maybe this is because I'm not part of this world, but I thought that the point of the prosperity gospel is its popularity. Those who believe that God has, and in fact, the proof of your goodness is your wealth.
Yes.
So if you're not doing well, this becomes insidious, of course, in a culture that's trying, in a society that's trying to make changes and adjustments, to say that the reason you're poor is because God doesn't love you.
Yeah.
But I thought that was popular. What are you saying? It's unpopular.
It is popular insofar as 1 zillion people ascribe to it. Not a technical number. But like, for instance, like Joel Osteen, he has a weekly television reach of about 7 million and his own Sirius satellite radio. And he has Victoria by his side to be his Love Your Life brand for women. So it is incredibly common. It is 24-hour TV. It is everywhere. On the other hand, it has never managed to break into the prestige economy. So, esteemed institutions, especially governmental power, universities. So the fact that I get to use this lightly ironic tone when I talk about it means that it has never broken into the ranks of, anyone with a gargoyle and a neo-Gothic tower.
No, but I mean, but that does make perfect sense for those who think this is God's will. Having her beside Donald Trump would, in many ways, it does make sense. I mean,
except
this is the proof of the prosperity gospel. Look, a very wealthy man has become the president of the United States, and that's because God. I mean,
that's
the logic of it.
Except
right?
It makes absolutely no sense for the following reasons. Prosperity gospel has never required institutional and structural solutions to their problems because they truly believe that if they just go directly to God, God rewards the faithful. And so most of the prosperity gospel has had therapeutic celebrities. So like Joel Osteen is not going to talk about the Republican Party or foreign policy. He's just not. You get a version of that. One narrow swath of the prosperity gospel is in folks like Pat Robertson and people who overlap with the religious right. But for the most part, they have not been D.C. insiders. And so the fact that Paula White is now a consummate D.C. insider is just theologically unnecessary for their message, and so therefore a complete surprise and joy to me.
All right, well, we'll talk about that, but let's move to another figure, because I think this might illustrate some of what you're talking about in the book and center it a little differently. Joyce Meyer, for instance, a well-known church leader, has her own ministry and her own television show. How does she do that dance? I mean, how do you appear submissive with that much personal spotlight?
Yeah. Well, and Joyce is a fun example because she's likely more popular than Joel Osteen. She has a huge TV viewership. Anyone who wants to see where she is only has to look at her 40-city tour every year and find the local conference center to see her. She's unbelievably popular in saturating the Christian market, and yet she does not have the popular man by her side. Her husband is Dave, and so one of the solutions to that is to make him the CFO of the organization and to find other ways in which he can provide spiritual oversight, is what they would say. Or if you get the mailers to donate to their ministry, you'll find that an enormous picture of Dave will be on the envelope. But at her conferences, she will be on the main stage under the hot spotlight for days, and he will be given the crappy Wednesday morning breakfast slot to talk about patriotism. And I love the incongruity. I think no matter what they are theologically, evangelicals and Pentecostals reward charisma. And when it falls on a woman, they accept it. They just have to find ways to massage it into the right place.
Talk a little bit more about that, because the way beauty is, part of that charisma is your personal charm and sex appeal, the way you look. But that also has to be tamed and controlled when it comes to the way women look.
Yeah. I mean, women have had to, especially in conservative evangelical culture, had to walk that very fine line of being beautiful but not sexy, attractive but still demure. What that usually means is skirts are fashionably on point but about 2 inches longer than they would be. Men, on the other hand, just had to have slightly longer or shorter sideburns depending on the decade. But I think it's probably most accurate to think of this as part of the way that conservatives wanted to win the culture wars. So in the late 60s and 70s, when evangelical culture really took off as its own series of industries, which supported these pastors, they needed to make an argument about why a Christian family was different than other families. And they would say, well, we don't support, a culture of divorce. They were concerned about the disintegration of families. And so they went from being these very pro-missionary, just put your kids in a missionary school while you go to Guam, kinds of not idealizing the family, to making women these powerful figures of what it was like to have a real Christian family. So their perfection with their kids, their loveliness, their sort of aggressive, it became increasingly like an aggressive heterosexuality. So if you're on the women's circuit, you really can't have short hair. You can't be ambiguous in any way. You find that they are, in a way, like the consummate Instagram influencers, because they have to be hyper beautiful to prove this point about focus on the family. This is what makes us different.
Kate Bowler, a Duke Divinity School professor, author of The Preacher's Wife, The Precarious Power of Evangelical Women Celebrities. Kate, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about the history of Black experience and Black excellence in the city of Raleigh, North Carolina. And that happens on The State of Things in just a moment. Stay tuned.